And now it's my pleasure to introduce to you Barbara Lawrence, who is the Executive Director of SWAP, the Street Workers Advocacy Program. And all she would tell me is that she has been involved in frontline administration for over 20 years. That sounds like you're very, very dedicated. Anyway, we're looking forward to hearing your presentation this morning.
Thank you, Helen. Well, I guess when I come to talk, it's not about me. It's about the message. So I brought some notes today. Although I've been around for about 20 years, I should be able to speak without notes and blindfolded. Because I've been around 20 years, I need notes. As I get older, my memory is not what I would like it to be anymore. I've forgotten far more than I remember. If anybody has any trouble hearing me, just kind of wave, and I sometimes forget and tend to speak fairly quietly. So the Street Workers Advocacy Project, I'll just give you a little wee bit of a brief history of the project. I think it was back, probably starting in 1991, the community, there had been recurring concerns around prostitution, particularly in the downtown area, the core area, neighborhood. For many years, there had been many different types of attempts to address that issue, primarily from either a neighborhood interventionist type of strategy or a police enforcement strategy. Nothing had proved particularly successful, and I think over time there developed a willingness to look at perhaps doing things in a different way. So the City of Regina, through their social development unit, the Core Neighborhood Association, called together a meeting, which was attended by approximately 30-35 different service providers, government representatives, and interested individuals in the community. And a smaller committee was struck out of that group to take a look at taking action. And what that group decided to do was what's called a participatory research project, which involved hiring two researchers to actually go out into the streets of Regina where prostitution took place and speak with the women. It was largely women at that time, or thought to be largely women, to speak directly to them, to find out what their needs were, what were some of the precipitating factors that led them to the street, what kept them on the street, what types of services and programs would they be interested in utilizing. So they hired two women, and both, I think, had somewhat of a background that made them compatible with this type of work. They were, I think, fairly courageous women. It was a new undertaking. I think the whole project was fairly courageous and innovative. So after 4 months... In the winter of 1993, these women were out on the streets talking to people who were working. They published the report in January of 1994, and the first drop-in center was opened in July of 1994 in the core area. It started as a pilot project, and it came under the umbrella of the Circle Project Association, which I'm sure many of you have heard of. That relationship lasted until I think it was June of 1996, when the Street Workers Advocacy Project incorporated as a legal entity. One of the unique things about the organization is, and this came from the research, directly from the research, it's our board of directors is largely an experiential board of directors, meaning the vast majority of our board members have worked on the street, or in some cases may still be working on the street. It's an incredible strength to the organization in terms of these are the people who inform our work. It is their knowledge, it is their expertise. that instructs us, that teaches us how best to work with this population. We have a smaller advisory committee made up of other community professionals that bring other complementary experiences to the organization. And that combination of skill, knowledge, expertise, wisdom has worked really, really well for the organization. It's rather a unique governance model, organizational model. But if you can get the right personalities who respect what they bring and respect what everybody else brings, it can really be a dynamic experience. One of the things that has happened with SWAP over the years, while our primary mandate is to work specifically with those involved in street prostitution and with youth who are at risk or sexually exploited youth, after probably the first 3-4 years or so, we started to see other people starting to come into the project, into the drop-in center. They were friends, family members, acquaintances of people who worked on the street. And over time, that unintentional population became quite significant, to the point where we have anywhere between 1,300 and 1,500 individuals that access services and programs through our agency annually. Now, we estimate, our best estimates for our street outreach project, which is an evening harm reduction program where we're out on the streets, is there's approximately 200, 220 people working in street prostitution. So that shows you that there is a far greater need in the community than of people who come from very, very similar backgrounds, very similar demographic, socioeconomic situations. Other than they're not working on the street, they share many, many similarities and commonalities with that population of those who do. And while it put a huge strain on the organization, it was very, very difficult to turn people away, people who are in desperate need. And I think it speaks, and certainly spoke back in the day, to the issue of, although we may have many organizations in the city, it's about accessibility, it's about comfort level. It's about people feeling, I can walk through these doors and I'm not going to be judged. That's huge. That's just so huge for the population that we work with. I think over time, our credibility, particularly through our street outreach program, really helped establish SWAP as an organization that was truly grassroots and was there for the population that we serve. So just to talk a little bit about programming. As a small organization, it's been like a roller coaster ride over the last 20 years. You start out really, really small, and you stay small for a while, and then some opportunity comes along. We recognized how many people really wanted to go back to school. There were just no places for them to go. There were no programs that they could get into with all of the issues they dealt with. So all of a sudden, there was a funding opportunity. Away we go. We were successful. So it's been kind of like a roller coaster ride for us over the years. We've slowly, very slowly grown. I think we started out with a budget of about $30,000, and we're now probably built $1.3 million. But that has been slow growth. But in hindsight, it's probably been good for all of the years of frustration that I've had with the lack of resources. I have seen where organizations have grown too quickly, and it has been to not only their detriment, but more importantly, to the detriment of the people that they would serve. One of the things that SWAP hasn't done, we haven't changed our mandate to chase funding. There's a lot of pressures in the human service field. There really, truly are. Just to keep your doors open and to stay relevant. You may stay relevant to your community, but are you relevant to funding priorities, which can change, every 6 months, never mind every year or 3 years. So it's difficult, but we've, like our commitment to the voices of experiential people, we have stayed true to what our purpose is. and what we're about in the community. And I think over time, although we have knocked heads with some government ministries or departments over the years, I think we've also gained a significant amount of respect from those same departments for staying true to our purpose and our mandate, our vision, and the principles upon which we work. I got off topic there a little bit, folks. Back to programming. So we have the drop-in center. It's open from 9 to 5, 5 days a week, Monday to Friday. Yes, it should be open 7 days a week and much longer hours, but so people can come in, access different types of services. We do food bank referrals, referrals to Sleep Country, referrals for basic necessities. We do counseling right across the spectrum. We have a telephone for people to use. We have a computer for job searches, for housing searches. It's a bit mind-boggling, and it's really hard to encompass through the drop-in center what we do. People walk through our doors, and whatever they walk through our doors with, whatever those challenges or those pressures or those worries are, if they wish and choose to share that with us and ask for our support, that's what we're there for. So many years ago, I kind of got to the point where I just thought, I've got to stop trying to describe what we do in the drop-in center, you know, because it's just, it's the breadth of human existence, the trials and the tribulations and also the joys, and that's why we stay. We have a number of programs we run. One is a street outreach program, which I referred to earlier. That's an evening outreach program, 4 nights a week between the hours of 8:30 and 1 o'clock in the morning. We are out in the street. It's a harm reduction initiative. It's a bridging program. It's about building relationships with people on the street. It's about connecting with them on their territory. It's about providing really practical supports that they need and can use. And it's about simply being there for them. It's about being respectful, not getting in their way, not being judgmental. And if you do your work well over time, that program can bridge people into other services and programs that we offer through the drop-in center. Because if people start to feel respected and trusting in your staff, then they'll take that risk, which is huge for them, to take that next step. We have a youth outreach program as well, and we did youth programming for about 12 years in the drop-in center. But one of the things we found, that younger population, anywhere from, probably about 17 and under, were really, really hard to engage in programming. They just weren't interested. They're out there, and this may sound offensive, and I apologize if anybody's offended, but it's, and perhaps I'm not, I haven't found out how to say it well yet, but these young people, quite frankly, from their perspective, they're having the time of their life. They just are. They're partying, they come and go as they please. They're incredibly independent. Many of them have been living very, very independently for years. They've, with little direction, little guidance, they may have been raising their siblings for years. But by the time they reach anywhere, they can be from 10 and on up, they're seeking other things. These young people have the same developmental issues, and if anybody's taken psych classes, you can go through the whole developmental spectrum. And they face the same challenges that any quote-unquote ordinary kid, teenager does. But the challenges with this population are even greater. Their risk-taking behavior, they have been forced to take risks that are so much greater than most of us can imagine since they've been very, very young. They've lived in circumstances that are so different that the typical developmental challenges are the same, but they are so much more profound for this population. Sometimes a lack of consistent nurturing in very fragmented families leaves them so incredibly more vulnerable to needing to be loved. which leads them very, very vulnerable to anybody who is going to say a kind word to them and tell them, I love you, and then put them out in the street 2 days later. And to them, that is love. All they need to do is hear it. So the pure and the peer pressure, again, it's much, much more pervasive for these young people because that often is their family. So we weren't able to engage this population through our in-house programming. So what we decided we needed to do is take ourselves out into the street, which is what we did through the youth outreach program. So we have two staff, we have a mentor and a youth outreach worker in that program, and they spend 95% of their time outside of the agency trying to stay connected with kids, trying to keep them alive, quite frankly, in many cases, trying to help them mediate with the criminal justice system, sometimes with the social service system, with child protection, sometimes with long-term workers, youth probations, youth workers, visiting them in Dojack, Orcadia. They used to visit in Orcadia. I believe they're shutting or have shut Orcadia Youth Center down. There are there's a stabilization home on one of the local First Nations communities. If some of the young females are in there, we've been invited to come out and visit with them out there. It's really about keeping in touch, trying to spend time with these young people and just stay connected with them and hope that, you know, when they need you, they're going to make that call. And that when they finally decide they've had enough, that, again, there's someone there that they'll make that call to. We also have an HIV outreach program. We've been running that program for a number of years now. The reason why the health region decided it was important to have this program at SWAP was because of that broader population that we serve. We have specifically two AIDS organizations in Regina, and our mandate was never directly associated with that, but of course it is an issue that impacts our population very highly. So it is that at-risk population that was particularly attractive to the Regina-Qui'Pel Health Region in placing this program within SWAP. Unfortunately, we originally had two staff. We were cut by one position a year ago, and that position now has to focus primarily on those who have been diagnosed as positives because she simply doesn't have, we don't have the resources to do the broader work that we were originally intended to do. And again, the majority of her efforts are spent out in the community. A lot of it's about linking people to care, engaging them first, building that relationship. And that's really important. I sometimes have some arguments with our folks at RQHR because it's just get them in for testing. And I said, wait a minute, folks. Like, you know, there's so much more than just a diagnosis. If you want to build a relationship with people, I mean, most people have a lot of denial with a lot of things, and certainly with HIV, and particularly in the population we work with. You know, but if you want to encourage them to address or look after their health needs or potential health needs, then you just don't grab people, throw them in your van, and take them to the ID clinic to be tested. It is about building relationships with people and maintaining those relationships over the long term. So a lot of intensive, really just basic work. All of these programs are really just basic work. It's about building relationships. If you can't build a relationship with people, they're not going to invite you along their journey. It really is quite, it's that simple. It's about being respectful. We used to go in and out of Dojack for many years. The girls would invite us to come in, and then the staff would sometimes, I think, be a little jealous of the relationships that we developed with the girls in there and find a reason to no longer have us come in. So it would kind of go like that over the years. And I went in for a little while, and it wasn't all that long. But what I found, I was still doing outreach for quite a while. I've done a lot of frontline work over the years, particularly when we were smaller. But I would have these young girls come up I'd be out working at night, and I'd have these young girls come up to the van, and I kind of recognized the face, but it was like, you know, they practically crawled through that window giving me a hug, you know. It was like I was their long-lost mother or sister or auntie or, you know, and it astounded me, like. And it took me a long time. A lot of things take me a long time to realize, but it was so genuine. It was so real. And I thought, like, what happened here? What have I done to have this type of response from these young people? And over time, I came to realize that those that we work with know so little of respect, of people treating them with respect. Those common human decencies that so many of us take for granted every day, all day long, that just are, because we're nice people, we're wonderful people. The population that I work with, no. They don't experience those things. One of the other programs that the two last programs that we have, one is a Building Bridges to Employment program, which is, we've been running that for a number of years now, so it's a combination of life skills, employment skills. We have put in a new piece of volunteer, and that has just taken off. You know, we try and put people into work placements, and we have big challenges with that. We take a group of people, and we put them into a volunteer experience, and they're absolutely amazing. They're incredible. Difference being they're all together, and there's safety in numbers, particularly if you're an Aboriginal person. Reality is discrimination and prejudice is still alive and well. The other challenge is, as people who have experienced that, they have also internalized that, and that internalization becomes a barrier, because even you aren't sure if you're going to be made welcome. You're not sure walking into a new job. We all have apprehensions. For many Aboriginal people, those apprehensions are even greater. So we do work placements, work assessments through the program as well. We also find, again, a significant number of people want to go back to school. We have been making a lot of referrals to a school, Piepot Urban School. They're running it in conjunction with Southeast Regional College. It's just down the street from us. They've got some remarkable staff, very small staff, but very dedicated and committed. They go the extra mile, which is what makes a difference. And we're seeing some outstanding results from some of these young people. And we are so, so proud of what they're accomplishing. The newest project that SWAP is delivering is in partnership with the Ministry of Social Services, Regina Coppell Health Region, and Armand Housing, is called Raising Hope, Moving Families Forward. It's a program we have been running for the last 2 years. It is a residential program. We have, through Armand, we have a 10-apartment complex. And it is for young women who are pregnant, struggling with addiction issues, housing issues, and a potential child protection involvement once baby's born. So there's 10 apartments, and ideally we prefer to have these young women come in prior to the baby's birth. We can have women come in within 3 months of delivering. The whole point of this is to try and keep families together. It's to provide those supports in place to help people address those issues which compromise their ability to parent. It's about trying to deliver healthier babies. In the 2 years, we've had, I think, 24 young mums come through the program. A number of those had delivered their child prior to coming into the program. I think of the 10 babies that were born, by young women who had were residing there. Only one required medical support for detoxification, and only one was apprehended by the ministry. So that's pretty significant. We've also had a number of children that were also in care return to their moms while they're residing at Raising Hope. So it's challenging work. Everybody says, yeah, I'll work on a program. I want to get better, you know, and once they get in there and get comfortable, they tend to kind of, geez, I'm comfortable here, and go back to, you know. So it's kind of one step forward, sometimes two back, and sometimes the other way around. It's, again, a harm reduction program. So, yes, we do have young women who will go out and drink or go out and use, and they will come back home, you know. We do keep babies safe, and we become very, very close to these families and very, very close to their children. It's I kind of like escaping from the drop-in center and spending a fair bit of time over there, you know, simply because it's just such a warm, warm place with these children and these babies. It's just amazing. And again, amazing, amazing young women. I see I'm coming quite close to the end of the time here. Just a couple of last things here. One thing, I've probably alluded to it, but 95% of the people that we work with out on the street, 95% of those people are Aboriginal. 98% are female. In the drop-in center, 89% of the people that come into the drop-in center are Aboriginal. 52% are female. And in terms of programming, 97% of the people that participate in our programming are Aboriginal, and 73% are female. That tells you something about our history as a province, as a country, that we have left a community, a vast, huge community of people in such desperate circumstances and situations that for so many they exist as a subculture in our society because we have not invited them in. We have not invited them, truly invited them to participate. We have come to this country perhaps uninvited, but we have done such damage in our wake, and we have so much work to do. I find it refreshing to walk through doors like this and hear somebody give thanks for what we hope will be a political rejuvenation. I have to be very, very careful what I say, and that's probably the only and last comment I'll ever make publicly. But it is refreshing. But we have so much work ahead of us. So with that, I will close, and I think Helen was going to, if there are any questions.
Thank you for the work that you do. I was just kind of curious with when you're talking about, well, actually, there's a couple questions. First of all, is there a lot of turnover in staff? Because when you are building relationships, I think it's important for having long-term, but I guess it is tied to funding as well. That's my first question. And then the second question, it was about the babies that are born, and you talked about the good or the better results from that. Like, so 8 children seem to have not major issues, either being apprehended or having addiction, or I'm not exactly if that's the right word. Is there a comparison you can make with another population where this is what the results normally would be?
Your first question again?
turnover and staff.
Right. Very astute questions. First of all, yes, with project-based funding, it does present challenges in terms of staffing, absolutely. And you are absolutely dead on about your comment about having long-term staff is important in terms of building relationships. That consistency is really, really important. What we have found, even when we do have to, you know, with our project funding, so it's a year's funding and then it's cut or the fund moves on to another priority. What we do find, you know, whether it's 1, 2, 3 years down the road, if we're able to get that program back up and running, regardless if staff are working, most have to work, so they're working somewhere else, they will come back. The people that we that seem to be attracted to SWAP by and large are very, very dedicated to this work. They're very dedicated to the population that we work with. Some of our staff are experiential people. I think in most respects, all of our staff are experiential people. Not all have worked on the street, but all of them have gone through significant life challenges that are somewhat reflective of those of within our population. The second question, no, we haven't done any real true evaluation of this project yet, so I don't have anything I could compare those numbers to. But it's going to be very interesting, and we are going to have to do something, I think, fairly substantive here down the road. We actually have just recently received 5 years funding through the Department of Justice Canada, so I'm sure they're going to want something, although they don't like to pay for it, but they're going to want something fairly substantive along an evaluation. I know the lead up to this initiative, a lot of work was done prior to that. Whether I could glean something from that, I'm not sure. We were part of focus groups originally through the drug strategy that looked at why were people not accessing, from this population, why were they not accessing prenatal care? There was it was very well known, and a lot of it was fear of being judged, fear of losing their kids, so they refused to seek out prenatal care. And I think over time we're going to see some pretty dramatic improvements.
Hi, my name's Jane. Thank you so much for coming this morning. This is sort of working on your off time, isn't it? So thanks for that. I'm just amazed that you and your staff are able to retain your own energies and keep on giving in the way that you must have to do in a program like this. It's, thank you. I'm sure it takes a lot out of you in many ways. My question is about your board structure. I'm really interested in your organizational dynamics with an involved experiential board. What a lovely term. I like that. And then your expert people, do they interact? Like, how does that actually work? And do they interact with your staff? You know, like...
First of all, thank you, Jane. Yes, they do. The advisory committee attends, and it's a very small group of people, but they do attend board meetings. And they are there in an advisory capacity only. And it is interesting. You know, you sit back and you listen to the conversations. For example, my board chair right now, I mean, she's an amazing woman, a young woman. She's going back to school now, raising 2 children. But she is... Her language is so street. You know, she's so blunt. We actually did a presentation to a group of, I don't know, it was a university women's organization. And it was... the majority of the people in that group were older. And at one point in time, they asked, so who are these men who seek out people working on the street? And right about then, I was kind of wishing I had the duct tape. Because she told them. And, yeah, so she's very, you know, so, but she, we laugh a lot. You know, I shake my head a lot. You know, but again, I think if you, as I said earlier, if you get the right people who respect what they bring and respect what others bring. In all of those years, there's only been one time that I can remember that we had somebody on the advisory committee that didn't work well. But I'm not sure. She was kind of like a one-woman show. I'm not sure she'd work well in any team because her mind worked at 150 miles an hour. Like, she knew the answer before anybody knew what the question was, you know? And when you are like that with the people that we work with, you shut them down, you know. And not to say that any of her thinking was wrong, but her way of work, being with people, really wasn't conducive to working well with them. So it is important to get the right combination of people, people who are very respectful and who have a high tolerance for perhaps off-color humor at times. So.
I think we only have time for one more question, so...
Hi. I was really happy to hear you say that you believe it's extremely important for the people being on the board, doing the work, are people from that community, the community that's at risk. And I wonder if you would be able to say how important you think that is. In other words, it's not a bunch of do-gooders, you know, some nice white middle class female coming in saying, well, you know, if you did this, mm-hmm. you'd be so much better off.
I never worked on the street. Some of my staff have. Some of us haven't. But what I have experienced, how am I going to say this? When I came to SWAP as a practicum student, I spent 3 months, and a lot of that seemed to be I was sitting around listening and visiting and listening and visiting, and I was going crazy. I'd go home each night, and I'd think, God, what did I do? You know, I'm just sitting around all day. So I was very, very frustrated. I never thought when I got my degree that I was going to go out and save the world. But I was just so frustrated over the course of those 3 months. It was in hindsight that I realized that was the true beginning of my education. That was really the beginning of my education. While some of my own personal experiences in life had prepared me for this work, prepared me with an openness and a non-judgmental attitude and a receptivity, I knew nothing of street life. I knew nothing of that world. So for 20 years, the people that I have worked with have taught me, and they are teaching me today. They are teaching me today. It truly... That's the importance. You know, we can drive through North Central or the Quarry area and see people working on the street, and intellectually we might be able to think, you know, get our heads around what that's about, but... It's the emotional experience. It's that lived experience, and then until you have a fairly good grasp of that, then you don't understand. So, and coming from so many people I've met over the years who mean well, who want to do well, and want to help, but when you don't understand, when you don't truly understand, your best efforts can end up hurting people. You can end up putting people in incredible danger. So it's really important to. Really listen and learn. We all come from our own history, our own place, you know. That's what we're comfortable, that's what we're familiar with. And if we want to help others, whether it's people working in prostitution or whomever, it's really important to listen and listen well, to hear, and to try and see the world through their eyes, through their lived experiences. So, thank you.